A reading from the Holy Gospel according to John. Before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And during supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, and tied a towel around himself. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was tied around him. He came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered him, "What I am doing you do not know now, but afterward you will understand." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no part in me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "He who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but he is clean all over. And you are clean, but not all of you." For he knew who it was to betray him. That is why he said, "You are not all clean." When he had washed their feet and taken their garments and resumed his place, he said to them, "Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you." The Gospel of the Lord. You may be seated. First, a quick lesson in some very ancient history. The oldest known temple ever to be archaeologically excavated is in southern Turkey. It's dated to be about 12,000 years old. So this temple was built right about at the close of the last ice age. And the temple itself seems to be designed for some sort of reenactment of the Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden story. And that's why we hear the story in almost all cultures. I mean, this was so ancient in its revelation to man and being passed down from generation to generation. This concept of the fall of man, the Garden of Eden and the fall, is paramount in all cultures. Now, if you happen to have listened to my Bible studies on Genesis on my podcast, then you already know that the story is viewed differently in different cultures. Now, the way it's presented in Assyria and Mesopotamia, Sumer and Babylon goes something like this. The Adam figure in that version of the story, his name is Enkidu, which means God is good. And he's a natural man. He lives in the forest among the animals, and he just eats whatever he wants, and he has all of his needs taken care of, just living as a natural man out in the forest. Sounds familiar, right? And he is enticed by a woman who's not named in at least as much of the epic of Enkidu that we have, which we don't have a lot of, but he's enticed by this woman who desires to civilize him. Well, we all know that's the role of women, right? To civilize their men. And so this woman wants to civilize Enkidu. So she invites him in and she gives him the fruit of civilization. She gives him bread and wine. Now, why is bread and wine the fruit of civilization? It actually is the basis. It's the backbone of civilization. Because when man moved from being a hunter-gatherer into being able to live in farms and in villages and establish a civilization and tribes, they built this upon two elements. Bread, because they learned how to grow and harvest wheat and make bread so that they wouldn't starve. They could save dried bread through the winter, and they could live in one place and survive. And so bread and wine, which purified the water, so they could remain there and drink pure, purified water, or what we now know as wine. And they were able to develop villages and towns. Now, in this epic, the fall of man is viewed as a good thing. Because when you have civilizations and you have peoples who are gathering together and living in towns and villages and settlements, then you can have war. You can go conquer them, and you can take their goods and their possessions, and you can take possessions of their fields, or you can enslave the people and demand tribute so that they work in their fields, but they have to give to the conqueror a portion of their goods. So it was viewed as a good thing that man had fallen from his natural state into the civilized world, where there could now be conquests and empire. Now, when Jesus comes on the scene, it is the very end of the age of empire. At the time Jesus comes, the greatest empire that had ever been built, and really the greatest one even now, no one has built an empire as powerful as Rome. The entire known world was under their thumb. They controlled all things. They had turned the civilized world into a single empire. And in this context, Jesus turns the world upside down. And he gives us a feast. He quite literally takes the fruit of civilization and the fruit of empire. He takes the bread and wine of civilization and empire, and he changes it into the bread of life and the cup of salvation. And then he goes and he washes the disciples' feet. He washes their feet. Now, a lot of theologians have forever argued over why hasn't foot washing become a sacrament? Why isn't it a sacrament? I mean, in the Gospel of John, his Eucharistic discourse takes place all the way back in chapter 6 at the feeding of the 5,000. When we get to this point in the Gospel of John, the very last night that Jesus is with his disciples, there's no mention of a Last Supper. There is just the washing of the feet. And so theologians have argued, why didn't this become a sacrament? And in a sense it did, although it was never ritualized. You see, the sacrament, when Jesus comes and he turns the world upside down, he reverses everything. He gives to the people a feast of Eucharist, a feast of thanksgiving. And he translates that into service to one another. Now let me explain to you how that works. Now suppose you had won a lottery, a big lottery. All right? I think they had one not long ago that was $650 million, and somebody won $650 million, of course. What happens then, of course, between the taxes that get taken out and this funny little thing called present value, that if you're an economist, you understand that, which means you don't get as much as I said I was going to give you. And so you wind up really with around $325 million. All right, you took a big hit, but that's still a pretty nice chunk of change, right? And so what do you do when you think, oh, wow, I have a bank account with $325 million in it? For most people, the first thing they think about is who they want to help. They want to help their children. Or if they're still living, they want to help their parents. And of course, they want to take a world cruise. And what do they think? Who am I going to take with me? And they start thinking of their best friend that they want to, you know, pay for their world cruise. When we receive something that magnificent, don't we think of, boy, I want to do something with this? There are people that I love that I want to help. And when Jesus gives us this Eucharistic feast, this feast of thanksgiving, he knows that he is giving us an amazing gift. And it is a gift of thanksgiving. It is a gift in which we are expected to respond with such thanksgiving in our hearts that it is the natural flow of events for us then to wash one another's feet, to serve others, to invite others into the fellowship. See, God has invited us into fellowship with him, to sit at the dinner table with him, to share in his life, to share in his very blood. And we, in thanksgiving, invite others to come to the feast. Jesus told many, many parables leading up to this about going out to the highways and byways that his house would be full. And throughout our Eucharistic prayer are peppered these little phrases of us doing such good works as you have prepared for us to do. The very opening antiphon, which I don't think we're going to sing tonight because I don't think we're doing those antiphons, but in the liturgy, the very opening antiphon of the foot washing service is Jesus' words, "A new commandment I give you. Love one another as I have loved you." This whole feast is designed not just to be an end in itself, but to create in us a Eucharistic life, a life of thanksgiving that reaches out and invites others to enjoy our good fortune of fellowship with God. See, I was saying in the Assyrian-Babylonian epic, the fruit of the fall is seen to be the civilization, the bread and the wine of civilization. In the Jewish background, it's a little different. What is the fruit of the fall? It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It is the law. The fall of man leads him into law, whereby we can manipulate and control others and give dictates to others. The law. And when Jesus comes and gives us the Eucharistic feast, he destroys both the civilization of empire and the covenant of the law. And he creates a covenant of love and a civilization of service, not of conquest and empire, but one of service. He reverses everything. He changes our lives completely if we let him. If we let him. So in this feast, in this Eucharistic act, when Jesus spends his last night on earth with his disciples that he has poured his life into for 3 years, and he has this one last moment to impart what he truly wants them to grasp, he gives us his Eucharist and he calls us to service, where death becomes life, where conquest becomes service, where law becomes love, and in the joy and thanksgiving of a completely transformed life, we go and tell the world that God is here.